different things. I like to walk outside in nature. I like to go to the reservoir or the state park or the beach and walk. I like to read nerdy theological books. And once in a while, after a long day of work, I like to unwind by watching the occasional Hallmark Channel movie. These movies are light, predictable, don't require a lot of heavy thinking, and always have a happy ending. For those of you not familiar with the genre, Hallmark Channel movies follow a pretty standard formula. A 30-something professional woman, usually played by a B-list 90s actress, is successful in her career, but not so successful in her romantic life. Her friends and family members wonder if she'll ever find the one true love where she'll settle down and live happily ever after. She is skeptical and a bit jaded with romantic relationships. She wants to find true love, but wonders if it's really a thing. Then, usually on a work-related trip, she finds herself in a picturesque small town, usually near a ski resort at Christmas time. And the snow is falling and glistening, and it's just a picture-perfect view. And through an unlikely set of circumstances, she meets a handsome 30-something man, usually recovering from his own bad breakup. And they seem an unlikely pair, and at the beginning of the movie, they are definitely not interested in getting together. But through twists and turns in the movie, an awkward ski lesson, a romantic candlelit dinner, a sleigh ride through a moonlit, drenched, snow-covered field, they realize they are soulmates who are meant to live together forever. And by the end of the movie, they are engaged and poised to live happily ever after. Roll credits. The Hallmark Channel movie concept is one that has been largely adopted by our culture as a picture of what true love is. That exhilarating feeling you get when you meet that special someone, that Mr. Right or Mrs. Right. You fall in love and live happily ever after and never experience any problems or conflicts ever. After all, if it's true love, it lasts forever. And if it doesn't, well, then it just wasn't meant to be. Deep down, we know this is a very shallow, superficial view of love. True love is not a Hallmark Channel movie. It requires commitment, sacrifice, and working through lots of issues. Even in our non-romantic relationships, we know that real love takes work. It takes time. It takes patience. It takes forbearance. In our polarized society, we may wonder if this true love is really even possible. With so much anger and hatred, we know the Bible tells us to love one another, but in practice, we know how hard this is. Even with people we naturally like, it's difficult to love, let alone the challenge of loving our enemies. Yet Jesus tells his followers to love one another. Love should be the primary hallmark of Christian behavior. So what does it mean to love one another as Jesus teaches? Is it really possible to do this? And how do we become the loving people Jesus calls us to be? We'll explore these questions today. As I mentioned, today's passage picks up from last week's passage. We're in John's Gospel, chapter 15. Earlier in the chapter, Jesus declares himself to be the true vine and his Father the vine grower. And God the Father prunes the vines so that they may become more fruitful, while the dead branches he cuts off to protect the vine from decay. Jesus instructs the disciples to remain in him, the true vine, in order that they might bear much fruit for God's kingdom. Jesus continues this teaching on abiding in him, now tying it to the concept of love. The beginning of our passage, verse 9, Jesus says, "As the Father has loved me, so I have loved you. Abide in my love." The word translated abide is the same word that Jesus used in the earlier section of the chapter, and it has the sense of dwelling in, living in, making our home in. The language here is of mutual indwelling. God the Father's love being woven together with the love of Jesus and this Son toward us and the Son toward the Father and us toward God and us toward our neighbor, and they're all joined together in this inseparable knot. They're inextricably fused together in love. Jesus then moves in verse 10, if you keep my commandments, you will abide in my love, just as I have kept my Father's commandments and abide in his love. This is a reiteration of the great commandment Jesus gave his disciples back in chapter 13, verses 34 and 35, where he said, I give you a new commandment, that you love one another. Just as I have loved you, you also should love one another. By this, everyone will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another. Here, Jesus connects this commandment to the indwelling love between God the Father himself and us. He reiterates the command again in verse 12. This is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. As they live in love, Jesus' joy will be made complete in them. The word joy comes from the same root as the word grace. Grace is the gift of God's acceptance and the power to live the kind of life God desires us to live. And joy comes along with this. As we live in relationship with God and Jesus through the Spirit, we experience the joy of love, which outflows from us to others and enables us to experience the joy in loving one another. Jesus then speaks of the self-sacrificial nature of love, beginning in verse 13, saying, no one has greater love than this, than to lay down one's life for one's friends. It's important to remember that Jesus is speaking these words to his disciples right before his crucifixion, when Jesus will sacrifice himself and lay down his life for the salvation of humankind. Though the disciples likely don't realize the extent to which Jesus will sacrifice himself on their behalf, Jesus prepares them for what is to come. Jesus calls them friends, knowing that in less than 24 hours, they will abandon him, and he will be hanging on a cross alone. Jesus continues his teaching in verse 15, "You are my friends if you do what I command you. I do not call you servants any longer, because the servant does not know what the master is doing. But I have called you friends, because I have made known to you everything that I have heard from my Father." Jesus has revealed everything to them about his Father's plans, and they are now more than just servants. They are friends. They have a renewed relationship, a special intimacy with Jesus. Jesus says to them in verse 16, "You did not choose me, but I chose you, and I appointed you to go and bear fruit, fruit that will last, so that the Father will give you whatever you ask in my name." The disciples did not initiate the relationship. Jesus chose them that they might bear fruit. Remember last week, the disciples are the branches dwelling in Jesus, the true vine, that they will produce good fruit from being attached to the lifeline of the vine. Jesus continues this metaphor here. We have this similar prayer from the one we found last week, where the Father will give you whatever you ask in his name. Now remember, this is not a genie in a bottle prayer, where God gives us whatever we want according to our own desires. But the prayer is connected to the dwelling in Jesus and in the love and in the command to love one another. The prayer is for God to enable the disciples to dwell in this love and enable them to realize the ability to love one another. Jesus closes this passage with yet another reiteration of the command in verse 17. I am giving you these commands so that you love one another. Obviously, the main focus of the passage is this command to love one another, as you see how many times it's been repeated just in this passage alone. Jesus talks about the command to love one another, but it is in the context of abiding in him and his love, and in the Father and the Father's love. The love Jesus talks about here is very different from the Hallmark Channel love so familiar to our culture. one that is based upon good vibes and exhilarating feelings, but then quickly fades when times get hard. 1 Corinthians 13, verses 4 through 7, paints a biblical picture of love. Love is patient. Love is kind. Love is not envious or boastful or arrogant or rude. It does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice in wrongdoing, but rejoices in the truth. It bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. This is a high standard of love, one that is not possible to achieve in purely human standards. It can be daunting to look at a passage like this, and like the one in John 15, and see Jesus' command to love one another as he has loved us. It can actually feel burdensome, like it's an impossible standard that we can't possibly expect to reach, so why even try? Yet the key to this verse, again, is not in our ability, but in our abiding. Our abiding in Jesus' love gives us the ability to love others as he has loved us. One commentator notes, loving one another can easily become an old-fashioned law. We all have enough to do, our own projects and tasks. When the preacher stands and thunders, love one another, it sounds like another project on our to-do list, and not an easy one at that. We have to be honest that the other we are asked to love, like others, is some mix of lovable and hard to love. And the seemingly simple act of loving one another is often very demanding. It asks for sacrifice, forbearance, forgiveness, empathy, compassion, thoughtfulness, and wisdom. It asks for time and attention, the most precious and fleeting, scarce thing we have. If after our sermons this Sunday, we set out to try and love one another, we've set off in the wrong direction. If we have to try and do it, then we're just adding an impossible burden. Trying to love one another is a recipe for guilt-ridden religion, in which the commandment does indeed become a commandment in every negative sense of the word. It's not the gospel, it's not what Jesus meant, and we're bound to burnout. The key to this commandment is the last phrase, as I have loved you. The love of the Son for his disciples is the source of the disciples' love. Often we interpret this phrase to mean that Jesus' love is the example or model of our love, for he calls us to the kind of radical love he shows. And that's true, but it's not nearly enough. Jesus' love is also the fount of our love, the ever-flowing spring of love that flows through the disciples. Loving one another is not meant to be a task, but a way of life. Loving one another is a natural outworking of being loved. It might help us to put emphasis first on Jesus' love for us. How has Jesus loved you? As the text says, he laid down his life for you. But what has that meant to you? What grace has Christ offered you? What mercy have you received? What help has God provided at a point of need? What renewal? We might even dare to change John's verb. What if we read the line in the present tense? Love one another as I am loving you. When we are in touch with, when we abide in the love of the living Christ for us and for all people, then love for one another flows as naturally as water from a fountain. It's like a tree that bears fruit. The tree doesn't try to bear fruit. It just does, because that's what a healthy tree does. This goes back to last week when we talked about abiding in Jesus the vine, as we are the branches. The imperative, the command, is not to bear fruit, but to dwell in the vine. result of our dwelling, but not something we can force. And yet, as the branches dwell in the vine, they will naturally bear fruit under the tender care of God the Father, the Master Gardener. And so it is with the command to love one another. We don't grit our teeth and try to love one another in our own strength. We love out of Jesus' love, the love we experience when we abide in him. In one of John's other letters in the New Testament, he says, "Beloved, let us love one another, because love is from God. God's love was revealed among us in this way. God sent his only Son into the world that we might live through him. And this is love, not that we loved God, but that he loved us and sent his Son to be the atoning sacrifice for our sin. Beloved, since God loved us so much, we also ought to love one another." Last week's image with the vine and the branches grow fruit as they dwell in the vine, and the vine becomes a life source for the branches. And as God prunes the branches in love, they become more fruitful. And as we dwell in Jesus' love, and Jesus dwells in the Father's love, and as we mutually indwell together, that divine love becomes a life source that goes through us, enabling us to love one another as Jesus loved us. We love in Jesus' love. We love because he first loved us. St. Francis de Sales poignantly wrote about the spiritual path of descent in the title of this reflection: "Where there is no love, put love, and you will find love." In the sinfulness and brokenness of humanity, God puts the love of Christ to transform them into beings who would truly reflect the love of the Creator. The classic verse from John 3:16 and 17 says, "For God so loved the world that he gave his only Son, that whoever believes in him may not perish, but may have eternal life. Indeed, God did not send the Son into the world to condemn the world, but in order that the world might be saved through him." As we dwell in this love, we shall become human beings who reflect the beauty of God's love to others in our hurting and broken world. So, friends, by God's grace, let us live in Christ's love, that we may be able to show that same love to one another. And may the Lord bless this message to our hearing.